From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, we'll have the latest on the double murder of two doctors in South Boston. Also today, Democratic candidate for governor Jay Gonzalez on why he thinks he's got the right stuff to lead Massachusetts.
We need real leadership. We need to aim high. There are many working families across this state who are struggling, and the status quo is not good enough.
And what kind of former president will Barack Obama choose to be? We got a glimpse last night of how much Obama might comment directly on current politics.
I hope that current members of Congress recall that it actually doesn't take a lot of courage to aid those who are already powerful, already comfortable, already influential.
Plus, an immigration advocate says America needs to rethink the immigration debate. This isn't a political or economic issue, he says. It's a cultural one. That's all next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And first today, the latest on the murder of two doctors in South Boston on Friday. This afternoon, the suspect, 30-year-old Bompumin Texera of Chelsea, was arraigned at his hospital bed.
Count one, charge of murder, with the alleged victim being Richard Field. Count two, the crime of murder, the alleged victim being Lena Balanos. A plea of not guilty has entered on your behalf on both counts.
Texera pleaded not guilty. The victims were engaged to be married. They were killed in their South Boston condominium on Friday night. And so now joining us with the latest, WBUR's David Boeri. He was at Tufts Medical Center for the arraignment. Hi there, David.
Hi, Meghna.
Okay, so first of all, what did we learn at the arraignment?
A couple of things that came out in the arraignment. It lasted only about 10 minutes or so. One was a suggestion, a strong implication that the motive of the crime involved robbery. When police went to the apartment, they found keys outside the apartment. Those keys let them into the apartment. It was dark after the firefight that ended with the suspect being shot in the left hand, the leg, and the abdomen. They took note. He was wearing black gloves, and as the prosecutor told the court, in a very remarkably conspicuous place close to the door was a backpack. The backpack was filled with jewelry, presumably, said the prosecutor, that belonged to the victim, Lena Balanos.
So, David, let me jump in here. The firefight you're referencing was the one that occurred between the suspect and law enforcement officers as they responded to calls
right,
to the condominium.
Yes, the only one there was. Correct. After the firefight, the room was dark. After the firefight, they went inside the room. They saw that backpack, but more grimly, they found the two victims. The cause of death, the specifics were not given, but we were told that the victims' hands were tied. They were victims of obvious trauma, and their bodies were not viable.
Hmm. Well, we've got some tape here of Suffolk Assistant District Attorney John Pappas.
Just inside the apartment door, Your Honor, a black backpack was located in a remarkably conspicuous area. I would describe it as that. Inside of that backpack, Your Honor, was filled with jewelry, presumably belonging to Ms. Balanos.
Mm. Now, David, is the suspect, was any bail posted? Was he even given the chance to post bail?
He is being held without bail, a ruling that was not contested by his attorney. He spent 10 minutes. His eyes were closed those 10 minutes, but we know that he was conscious. He said thank you at the end. But he will be back on June 8th for a probable cause hearing, but will be held without bail.
Mm. That's WBUR reporter David Boeri speaking to us from Tufts Medical Center for the arraignment of Bompumin Texera in the shooting, suspected shooting of two Boston doctors on Friday. David, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, let's turn now to Evan Allen, reporter for the Boston Globe, who's also been reporting on this story. Evan, it's good to have you back on the show.
Hi, good to be here.
So tell us, remind us, what more do we know about what happened on Friday night when these two physicians were murdered in their home?
Sure. So the Dr. Richard Field was actually able to send a final text message, a plea for help to a friend of his, which ultimately summoned police. But, you know, as you heard, when police arrived, it was too late. They engaged in this firefight. When they subdued Texera, they not only found the backpack full of jewelry, but they found a very horrific scene inside this 11th floor apartment. The victims, we've been told, have had their throat slit. Their hands were bound, and there was a message of retribution written on the wall of the apartment, and pictures of the victims had been cut up.
And so were your sources able to give you more detail on what that message of retribution might have been?
We don't have anything beyond that it was a message of retribution.
Okay. And what more have you learned, or have we been able to learn about Texera and his history?
Sure. So his only contact with the criminal justice system that officials have been able to find is this 2016 arrest for two bank robberies. They actually picked him up, only suspecting him of the 2016 bank robbery in Boston. And he confessed to having robbed the same bank in 2014. So he has two larceny convictions on his record. He served about 9 months and got out last month. At least that's what he told his ex-girlfriend. We did speak with his ex-girlfriend, who was shocked by what she'd learned. She hadn't heard anything about it until a reporter showed up on her doorstep. She had described Texera as charming and good with her 9-year-old son. She said she never saw him drink, smoke, or use drugs, and that he was always very well dressed. But she did say that he was very isolated. He didn't seem to have any contact with his family. He didn't seem to have many friends. He wasn't on social media. He told her that he'd been raised in Cape Verde by an aunt, and he'd moved to the Boston area when he was in his 20s and had a falling out with the aunt, and then lived in shelters. He also got in touch with her just a couple weeks ago after he was released from the House of Correction for the two larcenies. And by that point, they'd been broken up for more than a year. But when he got back in touch with her, she shared some text messages sent April 22nd and said they also had a long conversation. He told her that he wasn't a good person.
Right.
He said that that he didn't steal from people, he stole from banks. And he said that he would never hurt anyone. But he also said that he didn't plan to live long, and this was probably the last time they'd speak. But he denied being suicidal.
Wow. Well, Evan, obviously there's still so much that we don't know. But there's one question which you know, you've been raising in your reporting here, and that is how the suspect even managed to enter this building and get all the way to the 11th floor to the home of these two physicians, because the building supposedly had good security.
Sure. So, you know, it would be pure speculation for me to guess how he was able to get up there. One thing we do know, however, from court documents is that he listed, when he was arrested in 2016, he listed as his employer Palladian Services, and court documents reflect that he was actually a security guard at the same complex that 141 Dorchester Avenue is part of. It's a complex that contains several buildings. But the building in which the two victims lived is one of them.
I see.
Palladian Services no longer provides security for that building, but it looks like he had worked for the company that did provide security for that building.
Well, Evan, obviously this murder, this double murder, the double homicide is sending shockwaves through the medical community in Greater Boston. Just in a couple of seconds here, I mean, what more do we know about these physicians who were killed?
They were beloved. You know, Dr. Richard Field's patients described him praying with them, holding their hands, and always suggesting alternative approaches to drugs to try to get them out of any pain they were in. And for Dr. Bolaños, she was a pediatric anesthesiologist at Mass Eye and Ear, and she used to sing to her young patients. They were children. And she convinced all of her colleagues to take salsa lessons together. So she was just described as a very warm and lovely person as well.
Well, that's Evan Allen, reporter for the Boston Globe, bringing us up to speed on what we know both about the suspect and the victims in this double homicide that happened in Boston on Friday. Evan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Former President Barack Obama was in Boston last night. He was given the John F. Kennedy Profile in Courage Award.
I take this honor that you have bestowed on me here tonight as a reminder that even out of office, I must do all that I can to advance the spirit of service that John F. Kennedy represents.
Obama accepted the award just days after the U.S. House of Representatives took a significant step toward repealing the Affordable Care Act, the health care law that's a major part of Obama's legacy. So last night, observers wondered, as they have since Obama left office, how political would the former president get?
Our politics remains filled with division and discord, and everywhere we see the risk of falling into the refuge of tribe and clan and anger at those who don't look like us or have the same surnames or pray the way we do. And at such moments, courage is necessary.
Well, a direct call to courage. There he was receiving the Profile in Courage Award, but perhaps an oblique observation to the specifics of this political moment. So what does that tell us about the kind of former president Obama is going to be? WBR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks was at the JFK Library last night, and he joins us now. Hi there, Anthony.
Hey, Meghna.
Okay, so first of all, tell us, why is it that President Obama was the one to receive this award?
Well, it's worth noting that Obama received this award 3 weeks before the 100th anniversary of the birth of former President John F. Kennedy. And the Kennedy family honored him for a number of his policies, including restoring diplomatic ties to Cuba, fighting climate change, and as you mentioned, for his signature legislative accomplishment, the Affordable Care Act, which is now under assault by Republicans. And it should be noted as well that there's really a special relationship with the Kennedys around this issue. Caroline Kennedy, the daughter of President John F. Kennedy, along with her uncle, former Senator Ted Kennedy, endorsed Obama in 2008. That helped propel him to the presidency. And of course, Ted Kennedy made health care reform one of the focuses of his career and worked very closely with President Obama in passing the Affordable Care Act. So for all those reasons, he was honored last night with this Courage Award.
Well, yeah, and it seems like those would be all the reasons why one might expect him to be pretty passionate in commenting about what's happening with health care now. I mean, did he say anything specific about the debate going on?
Well, he did, and this is what's interesting about last night, because I think we were all wondering in the press room, was the president going to weigh in specifically? Because this was the third event that he's that he's done since he's left the White House, but it was the first in which he really directly challenged Republicans. And when he accepted this Profile in Courage Award, the president said many of the lawmakers who voted for the Affordable Care Act back in 2009 when it passed exemplified the kind of courage for which the award is named. So here's a bit of what he said.
These freshman congressmen and women knew that they had to make a choice, that they had a chance to insure millions and prevent untold worry and suffering and bankruptcy and even death, but that this same vote would likely cost them their new seats.
And Meghna, the former president noted that many of these legislators did lose their seats. And he said that was an example of the kind of courage that they had to stand up for something more important than their own political survival. And he challenged the current Congress, without saying Republicans, it was pretty clear that he was referring to them, to find their own courage in the current debate over repeal and replace the repeal and replace of the Affordable Care Act.
I hope that current members of Congress recall that it actually doesn't take a lot of courage to aid those who are already powerful, already comfortable, already influential, but it does require some courage to champion the vulnerable and the sick and the infirm.
So President Obama, they're willing to have some pointed words for Congress, which sounds good, but on the other hand, there's that tradition of presidents not former presidents not commenting on the current occupant of the White House. Did Obama say anything about President Trump?
No, I mean not specifically, and you know that's interesting too because you wondered how far he was going to go. Mm-hmm. We know President Obama can be a pretty tough critic and campaigner. We saw it on the campaign trail. He was as tough as anybody when he came out, especially as it drew close to Election Day, going after Donald Trump, but he's respecting this tradition that there can only be one president at a time. And so his comments are a little indirect, I guess, oblique. But While he never referred to Donald Trump by name, references to the president's policies were hard to miss. And here's an example. He talked about what he called the courage of the so-called dreamers. These are immigrants who came to this country illegally when they were very young and have lived here pretty much their entire lives. Here's what he said about the dreamers.
Who suppressed their fears to keep working and striving in the only country they've ever called home. And every American who stands up for immigrants because they know that their parents or grandparents or great-grandparents were immigrants too, and they know that America is an idea that only grows stronger with each new person who adopts our common creed.
So, Magna, pretty clear reference and response there to the Trump administration's hard line on immigration. So maybe this is the start of Obama becoming a little more engaged in the national debate. The Democrats would certainly like that, but we'll see what happens.
So this leads me then to the question that we posed at the top of this conversation, Anthony, and that is, what kind of former president is Obama going to be? Is he going to fashion himself into? He talked about a little bit about that last night. What struck you?
Yeah, it was interesting. It was sort of one of the more it was a funny moment in the speech. He made a comparison to former President John F. Kennedy. He noted that Obama is 55 now, which is kind of extraordinary when you think about it, right? This guy has served president. He's two terms as president. He's 55 years old. Now, if JFK had lived to serve two terms, he would have been even younger when he left office. He would have been 51. And last night, Obama quoted President Kennedy making reference to this fact. Here's what he said.
It has been suggested, he said, that whether I serve one or two terms in the presidency, I will find myself at the end of that period at what might be called the awkward age. Too old to begin a career and too young to write my memoirs. Now, I hadn't seen this quote when I wrote my first memoir at 33. I'm now in the middle of my second. Moreover, I expect to be busy, if not with a second career, then at least a second act.
Good quote.
I'm once again feeling so entirely unaccomplished at my age, Anthony, here. But any idea what this second act might look like specifically for President Obama?
Well, as we heard there, he's writing another memoir. That's going to take up a lot of time. He's going to raise a lot of money, of course, for his presidential library. And I think there's two ways to look at it. Maybe last night was the start of a more activist former president. As we heard at the top of the segment, the president called last night's award a reminder to him that even out of office, I must do all I can to advance the spirit of service that John F. Kennedy represents. And so maybe, you know, think about Obama, who was nothing if not an accomplished political organizer. He built a movement that, of course, carried him to the White House. Many Democrats would like to see him reemerge with those kinds of political organizing skills. On the other hand, we also know that President Obama is now on the professional speech circuit and about to cash in a big way, $400,000 to speak at a Wall Street conference next September. Now, how does that square with his past criticism of Wall Street fat cats? It's pretty striking, and especially given the last election and concerns about the economic divide, inequality, and the criticism that Hillary Clinton received. But this is what former presidents do, so we'll see. Interesting to see what ends up defining him more, cashing in on his presidential celebrity or being an ex-president that exemplifies the kind of political courage that he talked about last night. I think that remains to be seen, but it sure will be interesting to watch.
Yeah, and as you're sort of getting at here, Anthony, it'll be interesting to see how that washes back on Democrats currently in office as well, if at all.
Absolutely, and I think you'd have to say that given what the Democrats went through in the last election, I'm not sure it helps to have the guy who's still the standard bearer of the Democratic Party cashing in on Wall Street. I mean, as his first paid speech, $400,000 from Wall Street, really?
Anyway. Well, that's WBR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks taking us into what President Barack Obama's speech last night, accepting the Profile in Courage Award, tells us about Obama's political future. Anthony, thank you so very much.
My pleasure, Megna, as always.
Back in a moment. I'm Megna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Charlie Baker continues to rank as America's most popular governor. A poll last month gave Baker a 75% approval rating. Moreover, just 17% of respondents said they disapprove of the job Baker's doing. And yet, some Democrats are ready to challenge Baker in the 2018 gubernatorial election. We recently spoke with one of them, Bob Massey.
We have deep structural problems in Massachusetts that require us to be honest, face them, and address them.
You can go to our website, radioboston.org, to listen to our full conversation with Massey. Today, we're joined by another official entrant into the gubernatorial race, Jay Gonzalez. He's the former head of CeltaCare Health Plan and New Hampshire Healthy Families. He also served as the Secretary of Administration and Finance under Governor Deval Patrick. Jay Gonzalez, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thanks for having me, Meghna.
Okay, so you are going up against the nation's most popular governor. I mean, give us your pitch. Why do you think you'd be a better governor than Charlie Baker?
Well, I think we see the job very differently. I think we need leadership in the governor's office. We've got a lot of big issues that are holding people back, and we're not only not making progress on them right now, we're not even trying. I want to bring a different type of leadership where we're actually taking on these big challenges that people face. One of the things I love about us as Americans and as people in Massachusetts is we've always believed we can overcome any challenge if we set our sights high and we work for it. And that's the type of government I think we need and what we need in the governor's office. I'll give you an example. Early education and child care is one of many issues that we need to make progress on. This is an area where this could be game-changing for children in our state, particularly lower-income children. The research is really clear on this. And for their parents, if they had access to affordable, good-quality child care in preschool, it would allow them to go back to work. This is an area where we're doing virtually nothing right now that can make a huge difference for kids and their parents. It's a top priority of mine. And that's the type of leadership I want to bring to the governor's office.
Okay, so let's stick with early ed there for a second here. I mean, how you're implying that you believe that Charlie Baker has done little to nothing on this? Is that your take?
That's exactly my take. There's no plan for moving us forward. We have tens of thousands of families in this state who can't afford early education. We've got a workforce in the early education area that's getting paid an average of $25,000 a year.
So they can't even afford to send their own kids, right?
It's 40% of them are on state assistance. It's way too expensive for families to send their kids. And so this could be game-changing for kids in terms of giving them the solid start they need to be successful in school and allow their parents to go back to work. So this is something – this is an example of an area where this could be a huge difference for kids and families, where our governor right now has no plan for moving us forward or for taking us to where we need to be.
So what are the specifics of your plan? How would you, first of all, let's get down to dollars and cents. How would you pay for providing greater access to early childhood education?
So this, I'll be clear, this will cost hundreds of millions of dollars. I've been honest about that. But I'm supporting a ballot question that's going to be on the ballot in 2018, which would impose a new tax on incomes over $1 million a year. It would affect very few families who've done very well in this state and raise a lot of new revenue that would be invested in education and transportation. That would be a source of funding for this. But
so
I've been clear.
Can I just jump in here for a second?
Yeah.
So because a lot of folks that we've talked to are staking a lot of hope on that potential millionaire's tax. But even if it passed the voters, and Massachusetts voters actually don't take too kindly to tax increases of any kind at the ballot, this one would have to go through a constitutional convention, wouldn't it?
It's got to be passed twice by two legislative sessions, and it's already been passed once by the legislature. It's likely going to be passed again this year, and then it would be on the ballot. And if it passes at the ballot, it would amend the Constitution and become law. So the vote in 2018 would be the decision.
Okay.
And this is something I think we desperately need. Our governor has said no new taxes. He's taken no position on this ballot question. This is another example of him sitting on the sidelines and not taking a position. We got to be honest about the fact that we need additional revenue for our transportation system, the T, which is a whole nother area, for education, for things like what I just talked about in terms of early education and care, which will make a huge difference for families in this state. And I'm being honest with people. We need that revenue. I think this is a fair way to raise it, which is why I support it. We're asking those who've done great during this economic recovery, to pay a little bit more so that we can invest in supporting those families who've been having a hard time getting ahead.
Hmm. You know, you were Secretary of Administration and Finance under Governor Deval Patrick, so you know the ins and outs of the state budget very, very well. So you also know that right now the current administration, you know, Governor Baker's administration, is facing, what is it, almost a $500 million budget gap. So that's not just sort of missing projections by a little bit. That speaks to a fundamental structural problem I think Massachusetts has got to deal with moving forward. Do you have more solutions to those structural problems beyond, you know, a millionaire's tax?
Yeah. So one of the causes of this is Governor Baker's been mismanaging the budget. He's been irresponsible in how he's been developing the budget. He has not been following policies we put in place when I was there, like not budgeting against volatile capital gains tax revenue. And as a result, he's been in this situation where he's constantly having to go back and plug holes in the budget and scramble at the end of the fiscal year to get it in balance. And it's resulted in emergency cuts to really important programs like opioid addiction treatment programs and other programs that people depend on. And he's setting us up for a fiscal crisis. There's way too little in the rainy day fund right now. There was more in the rainy day fund when I left state government at the end of the recession than there is today under Governor Baker after a period of economic growth. And it is irresponsible. I have said one of the things that I would support is freezing the income tax rate where it is. It's supposed to go down. Right now it's 5.1%. It's supposed to go down all the way to 5% over the next couple of years. Governor Baker supports cutting that tax further, and I think we can't afford it right now.
Well, Massachusetts voters wanted it down to 5%.
They did almost 20 years ago, but we have a responsibility. The legislators and the governor have a responsibility to assess where we stand and the current context. And we simply can't afford to cut taxes further right now. We can't afford to cut the income tax. Governor Baker is struggling to preserve programs and services that people depend on, and it has impacts on people. And we just can't afford it. So I'm supporting freezing the tax where it is. And in terms of the new investments we need to make, I'm supporting asking those who've made more than $1 million a year to pay a little bit more.
Yeah. I mean, I hear you going hard and passionately against Governor Baker here. And I want to ask you about a couple things that you just said. You know, you're implying that the Governor Baker is mismanaging the Commonwealth. But on the other hand, when Governor Patrick left office, if I remember correctly, he left Governor Baker with more than $700 million budget deficit at that time. So, when you're starting with that kind of challenge.
Yeah. So I wasn't there the last 2 years of the Patrick administration. I think the representations about how big the budget deficit was that Governor Baker inherited, there are a lot of different opinions about that. What I can tell you is when I was there during the Great Recession, we successfully managed the budget. We did so while preserving important investments in public education at record levels and in infrastructure at record levels, and achieved the highest bond ratings in state history when I was there. Governor Baker has failed to manage the budget. He's been scrambling to close budget holes. He's been cutting funding for programs that need it, and he's put our bond ratings at risk. They're on negative watch. And this is supposed to be his whole case for being governor, that he's a great manager. He has not been managing well. The biggest reason I'm running, though.
So let me just jump in here.
Yeah.
If you were in his spot,
yeah.
if you had come into office when he did, what would you have done differently?
Well, if I had been in his spot, I would have followed the policies we put in place, and there were many, to ensure that we didn't get in this situation where we're budgeting against irresponsibly against revenues we shouldn't be, and in a situation where we're having to close budget holes at the end of the year. But here's the point I want to make. His whole case for being governor is that he'd be a great manager. I think he's failed at that in a lot of respects. The real reason I'm running, I think we can do a better job managing state government, but the real reason I'm running is it is not good enough to simply manage government well. We need to do that, but we need to be aiming higher. we've got lots of big challenges we're facing that are holding people back. And right now, we're not only not making progress on them, we're not even trying. Whether it's the transportation system or education or the environment or criminal justice reform, these are big issues we need to take on, and we need a governor that is going to set an agenda and provide leadership to make progress. That's what we've always been about.
So, again, I hear your as I punch my own microphone on accident, I hear your passion about this, but I have a hard time stepping away from the fact that I'm not sure Massachusetts voters agree with you. I mean, 75% approval rating across the Commonwealth in a blue state is pretty darn good. They're not seeing that same Charlie Baker that you're painting right now.
Well, my campaign just started. There hasn't been anyone out there presenting a contrasting view for the type of leadership we should have and could have and should expect, or holding him accountable, honestly, for whether or not he's actually doing a good job managing. But I'll tell you, as I go around the state and meet with people around the state, there are a lot of people who are very frustrated with a lot of stuff. Take the T as one example. People cannot depend on it to get to work on time. And this is another example of an area he said he was going to fix. It is not fixed. It's far from it. And, you know, he's jacked up fares.
But to be fair, the T has been broken for many an administration. Governor Patrick didn't fix it either.
No, but Governor Patrick did make steps forward in terms of providing additional funding for it. And the fundamental problem the T has is a lack of investment. We got to be honest about that. And Governor Baker has not proposed new funding for the T, other than jacking up fares on riders beyond what was planned.
But, you know, he's not the only politician on Beacon who doesn't want to increase or diversify or make new revenue sources. I mean, the Speaker of the House, Bob DeLeo, has said he doesn't want to raise new taxes or raise taxes, period, either.
I'm telling you what I would do as governor.
But and you would have to work with DeLeo.
I would. I know the speaker. I worked closely with him on a lot of issues when I was there, and we got a lot of big things done together. It's one thing to get along with the legislature and for everyone to get along and be collaborative, as, you know, a lot of people say Governor Baker has. But to what end? Yeah. We need to get things done. We need to make progress. And the T is a great example of an area where we got to be honest about the fact that if we're going to get the system to a place that people can depend on and the service that they deserve and get it to a state of good repair quickly, we need more money to invest in that.
You know, I really appreciate the fact that we've been engaging – that you've been engaging with me on matters of dollars and cents and policy. I don't want to run out of too much time before we have a chance to get a quick, better sense of who Jay Gonzalez
is. Yes.
I should have done this here at the beginning. But, I mean, I am running out of time here. But can you tell us one story from your formative years that really – or something that's happened to you that's led you down this path to want to be governor?
Well, I'd maybe talk about my parents. My mom's from Cleveland and went away on a foreign exchange program in college and came back married and to a 19-year-old Spanish man and pregnant with me. My father, who came to this country, didn't speak English, had never been to college, and he, through a lot of hard work and this sense of optimism and appreciation for the opportunities here, worked his way from laying bricks in a city sewer system to becoming a successful small businessman. And he is a real hero to me. And proves this point through his example that we can do anything we put our minds to. And I really think that is the value, one of the American values that we all share and that binds us and that makes us unique. And it's the way I view government and the way the governor should approach the governor's office. And that's the type of leadership I want to bring.
Well, I look forward to having you back so we can hear more of those stories about who Jay Gonzalez is, if that's all right.
I look forward to it, too. Thanks, Magna. I appreciate it.
Jay Gonzalez, he's Democratic candidate for governor. And as a reminder, you can go back to our website, radioboston.org, to hear more of our interview with another Democratic challenger, Bob Massey. Jay Gonzalez, definitely look forward to having you back. Thanks again.
Thank you.
We'll be back. I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Ali Noorani is with us now. He's executive director of the National Immigration Forum and former head of the Massachusetts Immigrant and Refugee Advocacy Coalition, or MIRA. Noorani is a self-described progressive immigration advocate who says that for years, he believed the immigration debate would be won on the strength of the basic political and economic arguments in favor of an America that welcomes newcomers. But Ali Noorani now says he was wrong about that. He offers up a completely different view on how to consider the immigration debate. It's in his new book, There Goes the Neighborhood, How Communities Overcome Prejudice and Meet the Challenge of American Immigration. Ali Noorani, welcome to Radio Boston.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
First of all, I just want to read a quick paragraph from early on in your book. You write that several years ago, we, being immigration advocates such as yourself, we believe the political power of the movement should be respected and rewarded. We failed to understand the seriousness of the nation's cultural crisis. We were having a political debate when the country was having a cultural debate. Why was that revelation so important to you?
Well, it all stemmed for me on one day, December 18th, 2010, when two things happened. One was Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed, and second, the DREAM Act was defeated in the United States Senate. And on that, from that day, I looked backwards. And over the course of 2010, I realized that the LGBT community had engaged the military establishment, engaged families, engaged policymakers on the question of being able to serve your country openly and freely. Whereas in the immigrant rights community, we registered voters, we turned them out, we won the political battle. But at that moment, I realized, well, you know, we can talk politics all we want. But at the end of the day, that voter in Kansas is wondering when the immigrant moves into their neighborhood, is their culture going to change? Are their values going to change? How much is their neighborhood going to change? So we needed to change our strategy of how do we engage the broad swath of America in this conversation so that ultimately we're talking about culture and values, not about politics and policy.
Yeah, but so how important is that? I mean, recognizing the difference between the political debate and the cultural one, because it seems like it's a profound shift in how you're saying advocates should look at the basic ways in which we talk about immigration.
Absolutely. I mean, you look at the presidential debate around throughout the course of 2016, the entire conversation Donald Trump had with America was around fear. Fear of the other, fear of changing culture, fear of changing values. And we were having a political conversation. So what that means is that as an organization, as a movement, from our perspective, we want to be able to engage conservative and moderate Americans on a question of faith, on a question of law enforcement or public safety, on a question of economics and what it means to an American worker and their family. And all of those things are, you know, they come well before the conversation of, you know, immigrants and immigration to the United States and, you know, what's in it for the immigrant.
Yeah.
Let's think about what's in it for the American.
Well, you have some very powerful examples in the book, which I want to talk with you about in just a minute. But you're saying so many interesting things right now. I'm just curious, what do you think were the drivers that prevented immigration advocates from seeing the cultural debate that was going on? When you were saying just a moment ago that, for example, LGBT advocates were able to see that their path to success was by engaging in values. I mean, why couldn't immigration advocates see that too?
Because I think we believe that demographics is destiny. And we looked at, you know, states like California, New York, Illinois, to a large degree Massachusetts, and we made the assumption that the rest of the country was the same. You know, we lived and operated in our bubbles. The rest of the country is not California. The rest of the country is not Massachusetts. So we had to, you know, the way I put it in the book is that we had to meet people where they were, but we just couldn't leave them there. And in order to do that, it meant that organizationally and through our staff and through our strategy, we need to have, frankly, some kind of awkward conversations. But at the end of the day, I think that there's a debate happening in the country that is not always reported in the media. And there's a debate of, you know, from a conservative perspective, okay, how do we get to a better place?
Yeah. Well, it's so fascinating to me because you look at several states and several cities and neighborhoods where there's been profound change, unexpected change, and an equally unexpected reaction to that change. And I was wondering if we could just start with South Carolina,
mm-hmm.
First of all. You spent quite a bit of time there and quite a bit of time writing about it. What's special about South Carolina?
South Carolina is interesting because it has seen the fastest growth in the Latino population, second only to North Carolina.
Like quintupling, right?
It's amazing. The state has changed dramatically. And when you look over the last 20, 40 years, you see that the textile mills moved to Mexico, but it seemed like Mexico moved to South Carolina. So you take that demographic shift, then the fact that, you know, 40-50% of the population in South Carolina is evangelical Christian. So you have this cultural conversation and cultural, you know, potential battle take place. So I spent a lot of time—
Not to mention the fact that it was, the first to join the Confederacy. Did I get that right? And the last to leave? Can you leave
right.
the Confederacy after they were defeated in the Civil War?
And so
there's a lot of history layered on top.
There's
what
a lot of history. There's a lot of history. So I spent a lot of time in Spartanburg, South Carolina, upstate South Carolina, that had seen this shift happening. And I talked to, you know, a principal of a school there, some teachers, the leadership of one of the largest Southern Baptist churches in the state. And I realized that each one of these individuals were engaging in this demographic change from a perspective, okay, how do I, you know, go through this change? How do I talk about this change? How do I help my community engage in this change from a perspective of faith, from a perspective of education? And the stories they told me were incredible because it was an honest conversation of kind of how do you move forward in a really, really difficult part of the country.
Right. I mean, you write about Dr. Barrett Duke and the fact that – well, tell us a little bit about who he is.
Mm-hmm. So I met Barrett when he was the vice president of public policy for the Ethics and Religious Liberty Commission of the Southern Baptist Convention. The Southern Baptist there's the second largest non-Catholic denomination in the country. They represent approximately 16 million people. Barrett, born and raised in New Orleans, you know, who has gone through a life of, you know, dramatic change. He, you know, converted to, you know, became an evangelical, born again as an evangelical Christian, went to seminary, but he never had a direct experience with an immigrant to change his mind. So what he told me is that he turned to his Bible to learn and to understand how he should be welcoming the stranger. And what I found in that conversation with Barrett is what I think we find over and over across the country. There's a tension between welcoming the stranger and being a nation of laws.
Mm.
And the way that Barrett described it to me is that through his Bible, his heart was made, you know, the hardness of his heart was gone because he understood that he had to welcome the stranger. On the other hand, as he said, he can always go back to that place of believing only in the rule of law and that people have committed an illegal act. So there's that tension that I think we often overlook.
And yet he told you he found a way to resolve that tension, though, which was, I thought it was very telling because, you know, regardless of what faith one might be or if one ascribes to any faith at all, I think there are a lot of people who feel exactly the tension that you mentioned, which may be one of the reasons that led them to, you know, vote for Donald Trump, for example.
Exactly.
So how did Dr. Barrett Duke resolve that tension?
I don't think it's ever resolved.
Okay.
And that's, you know, for those of us who kind of are the believers in immigration reform and the value of immigrants and immigration, we believe that, you know, we just think that, okay, everybody's going to kind of reach that point and we're going to be okay. For Barrett and for so many others across the country, that tension has never resolved. And, you know, I think we do ourselves a disservice if we don't understand that there are fears and anxieties that are not, you know, bad or mean. They're just real.
Yeah.
And I don't think we can assume that, you know, all these questions go away for people.
But what was interesting in the book is you wrote that that he had actually found a way at least to see the bigger picture in a different way. That he actually saw the tensions over the national tensions over immigration. He saw the government was really at fault there, right? Because he said that if the government hadn't found a way forward to immigration reform. And you have this great quote from him that he said, that he said to you, "Why should I blame the immigrant for some of my own country's failings?"
There's a firm belief within evangelical life and many, for many people of faith, is that, yes, we're a nation of laws, but our nation's laws must be just. And if they do not treat people justly, then they, as Christians, have a higher calling to make sure they're welcoming the stranger and taking care of people compassionately. And again, it's that tension. So when the Southern Baptist Convention, the Catholic community, the Mormon community is calling for immigration reform, they're doing it from a perspective of, okay, we need a nation of laws that treats people justly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a that's a it's a process for people to arrive there, and it takes a combination of experiences, but also an understanding of what of their own values framework. Yeah. And for those of us outside of that values framework, we can't. It's not our job to judge that. Yeah. We have to let people go through their process and help them.
Well, let's move over to the Mountain West because you wrote the fantastic story of Utah and different communities in Utah led by the Mormon Church and how it arrived at what I find to be a novel and courageous view on immigration. So what happened out in Utah?
So in Utah in 2010, after the Arizona SB 1070 Show Me Your Papers law, five state workers took it upon themselves to send to the governor and law enforcement a list of thousands of people they alleged were undocumented and people using state benefits. In reality, they were just people with Hispanic surnames. What happened is that the Republican Attorney General, conservative thought leaders, the Chamber of Commerce, the Catholic Church, the LDS Church banded together over the course of 2010 to create something called the Utah Compact. And that compact was, five basic principles that resonated with conservatives in Utah of how to have this conversation in a more constructive way. That compact changed the debate in Utah, I think changed the debate nationally, stopped SB 1070 from coming to Utah, but then also created a level of understanding and dialogue within the state so that now you have the state of Utah, speaking about welcoming refugees like, frankly, right. Few others are.
But as you said, though, it was deeply grounded in the values of Utahans who obviously the Mormon Church is the primary power there, religious power there. And the compact, some specifics of it, you can see that. Like, for example, they talked about how Utah supports families.
Right.
And so therefore they couldn't support any immigration policy which would tear apart families. They also talked about how, Utah wanted to be a welcoming business environment, but in a global economy, they couldn't be a welcoming business environment if they were seen to be keeping people out.
Right.
So it was rooted, again, in these local values.
But it was also rooted in the philosophy of the religion.
Right.
So when I was out there last April interviewing folks, I was there for General Conference, which is their semi-annual gathering of Mormons around the world. And 21,000 people are in an auditorium in Salt Lake City on the grounds of the Mormon Church. And it's an incredible space. And one of the sermons that afternoon was delivered by Elder Kieron about refugee resettlement. And he spoke movingly, and there was not a sound in the entire auditorium, of the journey of Mormons from the east to the west and what that meant to the community and how that leads the Mormon community to have such a strong belief in welcoming and protecting refugees. Yeah. It was just a remarkable moment. And as I was told later, it was one of the first times a sermon was so topical, meaning that it was at a moment where the nation and the world were debating refugee resettlement. And here is this incredibly powerful moment within the LDS Church to the LDS community.
Yeah. So Ollie, I have a question for you, because obviously your book rings with this clarion call to really approach immigration from this different perspective, from wrestling with the questions of culture, of value, acknowledging people's fears and concerns, meeting them, as you said, where they are, and then bringing them with you. But I'm curious, what would be your response to many people who might be hearing this and saying, okay, I understand, but on the other hand, I don't necessarily want to meet some folks who are worried about immigration where they are, because where they are right now is with Donald Trump, with President Trump, who began his campaign by vilifying immigrants. Beginning, middle, and end of his campaign was marked by that. He aligned himself with xenophobic nativists. He's been crafting a policy that sees immigration entirely in the context of national security and not in terms of American values at all. In other words, there are no shared values here.
Just like Donald Trump tapped into the fear and anger of clearly a large number of Americans, there are also a large number of Americans who are also fearful and angry from the opposite perspective. And I think it's important for the resistance movement and others to be, fighting for people's rights, for the immigrant community to be making sure that people know how they should be protected by the law, and that there is, that the Trump administration and others are feeling a forceful pushback from as many Americans as possible. On the other hand, I also think it's incredibly important that those Americans who would identify themselves as politically or socially conservative are also part of a constructive conversation. I mean, the hard left versus hard right, it's not a sustainable path for us, whether we're talking about immigration or any other issue. And I think that, you know, whether it doesn't matter which issue we're talking about or thinking about, we have to be more sophisticated of kind of how we're talking about it, who's saying what, and ultimately, how do we advance a strategy that moves these issues?
Is this the only way you believe forward in we have a couple seconds here, of solving what you call America's identity crisis?
I think so. I think we've got to meet people where they are. We can't leave them there. And it's not easy, but I think it's incredibly important.
Well, Ali Nourani, he's executive director of the National Immigration Forum and a former executive director of the MIRA Coalition. His new book is There Goes the Neighborhood, How Communities Overcome Prejudice and Meet the Challenge of American Immigration. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's it for today. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.